Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. This is our last Clown Bag Seminar of the fall term. It's been a great series, and we're continuing with our emphasis on housing difference. We had affordable housing, and today with Professor Kristen Krosny of Westchester University, modeling predatory lending. Kristen's also, I said earlier, someone who has the zoning maps and the redlining maps from Pittsburgh. She's got a lot of knowledge from previous work about this type of activity in Pittsburgh, but also, of course, nationally. Kristen and I were just chatting, and some of you might remember we've had a Brown Bag speaker, professor from Temple, Dave Bartelt, and she worked very closely with Dave at various points, and I think we have a little bit of things about mortgage lending and predatory lending. Some of us worked with Dave through the National Neighborhood Indicator Partnership, so we're really looking forward to this exciting talk. Kristen this year went to the Department of Public Policy and Administration from the Geography Department. She's a 2006 PhD in Urban Planning and Policy Development from Rutgers, so she's kind of back into the policy side. We were talking about that. It's been a really great move for her. Bachelor of Science in Geography and Environmental Systems from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And her research emphasizes many aspects of housing and, of course, spatial patterns in lending and discrimination and populations most at risk. So, Kristen, welcome to Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you. Today we're going to talk about predatory lending, and we'll start thinking about what is predatory lending. I'll review some research questions that I have addressed previously, things that I'm still working on. When I think about predatory lending refers to loan terms, mortgages that are abusive. This can include things like excessive fees and interest rates. It can be loan terms such as prepayment penalties, balloon payments. Things like negative amortization. Traditionally with mortgages, your payment stays the same, whether it's your first payment or payment number 360, the last payment on a 30-year mortgage, the amount's always the same. The difference is how much of that payment goes towards the principal, or what the original loan amount was, versus the interest, which is the cost for you to do that. Typically, at the start of mortgages, a much higher percentage goes to the interest rates. Later on, you're paying back more of the principal. With some of these predatory loans, they include negative amortization. So instead of increasing the amount you're paying back on the loan over time, so your principal owed will decrease, it actually increases over time because the terms that they built in continue to charge you additional fees. Predatory lending is a concern for me, and why I think it should be a concern for all of you, is it has impacts for the individual borrower. These can go over to the surrounding neighborhoods and cities, and this also has national consequences. Predatory lending undermines one of the core principles of U.S. economic and housing policy, the idea that home ownership is desirable. It stabilizes neighborhoods, creates places that are beneficial and desirable to live. Areas with higher home ownership rates tend to have better performing schools, tend to have higher median housing values, have less turnover. Home ownership is also viewed as one of the primary methods which people accumulate assets. For many Americans, their home functions like a retirement vehicle or a savings account. You want to build out the back, put in a new deck, put in a swimming pool? You can borrow against the equity in your house, the difference between what your house is worth versus what you owe. Someone becomes ill, you're unable to work, you have higher health care costs than expected. Maybe you need to take a leave of absence for yourself or someone else. You can borrow against that equity to help get you through that time period. Someone is graduating high school, they'd like to continue their education. You can take out a home equity loan to help fund that education. In cases of predatory lending, those core principles are questioned because they are designed, in effect, to basically extract equity, decrease accumulated assets. So they're removing all of those economic benefits of what it means to be a homeowner. And instead of improving an individual's economic stability, their potential to build wealth, it's undermining.
It's making it less advantageous.
Much of the examples of predatory lending come from
around 2000. It's a time period that after major deregulation in the banking sector, access to credit increased. Also start to see less standardization for interest rates. So less risky borrowers were able to borrow at lower rates. More risky borrowers had higher interest rates. So is that balance between the cost of the mortgage would reflect the risk inherent in the borrower?
In 2000, time period where we had increasing homeownership, increasing access to capital in the form of mortgages, leading up to the bubble and rising housing values that then brought us into the Great Recession. I don't think that this is just history. History itself is important. You know, we're still seeing individuals and neighborhoods that are struggling with the negative consequences from predatory lending, from rampant predatory lending in neighborhoods. Individuals have been left with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt and foreclosed on as individuals. They are still dealing with that. And I also think it's still relevant because there's not evidence to suggest that even with the work of Elizabeth Warren, work of the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau, that while it's tried to shine a brighter light on mortgage lending, while it's tried to increase protection for borrowers, there's not evidence to suggest that these have been wiped out of the mortgage market yet. I'm particularly concerned that as we see an increase in neoliberal policy, as we start to see the types of cabinet picks that are being chosen by our president-elect, I question and wonder that the advances that have been made in the past decade in terms of increasing transparency, a committed protection to homeownership and to borrowers, that it's going to be undermined. And we're going to find ourselves right back where we were 15 years ago, if not worse. For me, predatory lending is also an example of the more things change, the more things stay the same. I had the benefit of sitting in Devin's honors thesis defense today. These are residential security maps that were made by the Homeowners Loan Corporation in the early 1930s. We have Philadelphia, hopefully you recognize Pittsburgh, and we have Los Angeles. There were national guidelines. The process was set in terms of how these assessments would be made. And this was part of Hulk's task to start to assess the idea of risk. What makes this time period unique is this is after the Great Depression. This is a change in FDR's policy development, the implementation of the New Deal. And this is the starting point for when housing becomes a driving force in economic development and economic stability. And at this time, because of the reinvention of the now modern-day mortgage instrument, the idea of risk changed from an individual borrower, because loans were typically between 3 and 7 years of interest only, to now they were going to be the 20 to 30-year mortgages that we know today. So from an institutional perspective, from a financial institution perspective, it was not just about whether an individual person is a good risk, or what type of risk they represent. It was now about the idea of neighborhood and trying to understand neighborhood change. We can look back, and this really starts to solidify the idea of how access to capital in terms of a binary question. Is capital flowing into these neighborhoods or not? But also a more nuanced approach, thinking about what are the costs of that? What are the interest rates? It's not just yes or no, but how much? Are the needs of the residents being met? Access to credit controls things like whether or not a housing market is going to be stable and vibrant. If capital is not available, good luck trying to sell your house. Good luck trying to buy a house. Having that money to finance it is a crucial component. You can find the house of your dreams. You can agree with the seller on a price and a date. But if financing is not available, if that financing is not affordable, you cannot assume it based on your income, the deal falls apart. And in many ways, neighborhoods are spaces of investment with mortgage capital flowing in and out. When mortgage capital is available, we consider perhaps to be reasonable terms, we see areas grow, they're stable, they develop, perhaps they get redeveloped and we see improvements.
When they are excluded from traditional access to capital, we see them decline. We see them die. We see disinvestment. We see abandonment. We see declines in housing quality. We often see population leaving, and also we see declining socioeconomic status of residents who remain or the new residents who come in.
When we look at these maps, we can say they look similar, things are the same. These three cities are broken down into four categories, with green being the best, considered the most desirable, with red being identified as declining. These were areas that were urged that mortgages should not be lent here. These were areas that it was extremely risky. When you look at the percentage of these cities that received each green, it was different though. The way that these appraisals were conducted, the way that grades were assigned, varied from city to city. So in Philadelphia, the African American, black, and foreign-born white population really increased the amount of yellow and red areas that were being defined and considered one of the most defining characteristics when risk was assessed. In Los Angeles, very small African-American and black population, it was mostly not just foreign-born whites, but the Mexican population that you see when you look at the narratives. That was what's driving it. As Sabina mentioned, I've previously looked at, when we consider what the characteristics were of these places, and when these appraisals were done, what are the explanatory characteristics for how these grades were assigned? So not just looking at the narratives, what the on-the-field appraisals told us, but trying to actually look at the underlying census characteristics. Short story is it's a regression model. Things that are marked with stars are variables that were statistically significant. These are the beta coefficients. If it's negative, it has a negative relationship. As the variable increased, they received lower grades. The larger the number, the more significant that relationship was. In Philadelphia, whole grade is explained by race, African-American, immigrant white. That time there's a distinction with the social construction of race that all whites were not considered equal. There was a strong distinction between native-born whites versus immigrant and foreign-born whites. And then even within foreign-born and immigrant whites, there was distinctions based on which region within Europe and which global region people were emigrating from. We see rent, owner occupancy, and in Philadelphia, a big explainer is the age of housing. The percentage of houses that were built before 1920 is one of the strongest predictors of hope rate. But this means that they're internalizing the idea of the desirability, the quality of that house, is what's going to affect the long-term risk, the desirability. Those older houses were using different material. They were typically smaller, often attached housing. So they were considered less desirable and were a very strong predictor for the downgrading of areas. In Pittsburgh, still see African-American, black, immigrant, white housing value. But the age of housing and the style of housing is very small. In Pittsburgh, instead, it's the lower rent areas and the areas with lower owner occupancy rates are the strongest predictors of downgrading. So again, this is the example. The more things change, the more things stay the same. They're starting out with a national system. From city to city, neighborhood to neighborhood, they're actually using the same survey instrument. But between the differences in local knowledge, the individual appraisers who are conducting assessments, and then the characteristics of these cities, you see differences in how grades were assigned. To me, this comes back into the idea of predatory lending. In many ways, I believe predatory lending is an unintended consequence. That with the redlining, starting exclusion at the very birth of the modern day mortgage system as part of the New Deal, continuing through expansions of credit in the 60s and 70s. Predatory lending is an unintended consequence of policy and programmatic efforts to increase access to capital. And in some ways, it's the pendulum swung from areas and individuals being entirely excluded to now they've been included. They've been included, but it's at a different cost. They're not able to access mortgage markets with the same terms, with the same fees, with the same benefits, the same opportunities. And so we've moved from redlining to almost a form of greenlining. We're in the early 2000s, so there's almost an overabundance. A lot of this comes from the rise of mortgage-backed securities, Wall Street taking a strong interest in the performance of mortgages. Comes down to not just is there this strong national policy preference for home ownership, but one of the cornerstones of that is the idea that your house is a stable investment. Not only is that value not going to decline over time, the expectation is that it's going to appreciate. So from a purely investment standpoint, they were often seen as being very sound investments. Mortgages are being written. Clearly those borrowers represent pretty low risk. Those mortgages wouldn't have been written in the first place, right? They're homeowners. Homeownership is great. We're going to see that increase over time. So even if there is a blip and that borrower defaults or we have to foreclose, we expect that the value of the house will exceed what's owed, that we'll have adequate collateral. We'll be able to, if we have to take the house, to liquidate, and we're not going to take a loss. With predatory lending, though, each one of those assumptions has to be called into question. There weren't the same benefits to individuals. Again, instead of trying to use mortgage lending as a way to increase asset accumulation, it's now equity extraction. And in many ways, because there was this emphasis on being able to turn out loans because there's demand in the secondary mortgage market and the mortgage-backed securities are really just continuing to funnel money in, that the risk of those loans was not always transparent. And that's really what led to the Great Recession starting in 2007, was that the risk of many of these predatory and subprime loans was not adequately represented and was not adequately understood by the investors who were purchasing those mortgages. And so we see, again, coming back to what I stated earlier, so we see at an individual level that those that fell victim, they themselves are now having significant economic issues. Comes into housing issues. So now, not just they have greater debt, but in many cases, they're now homeless. They've lost their home. Where did they go? We see the neighborhood issues. We now see housing markets starting to soften, that there's more of a supply available than there's demand. Because so many of those mortgages ended up being higher because housing prices were higher in the earlier part of the 2000s, as well as they were overinflated amounts as that equity was sort of extracted from the property, extracted from borrowers. From an institutional perspective, they're not necessarily able to liquidate, that they can't sell those properties for what was owed on them. See a rising number of REOs or real estate-owned properties. Many cases, financial institutions now have to hold and become property managers because they can't dispose of those properties. They can't liquidate, they can't sell. And then coming back to why I believe there are national consequences here, is we now have these challenges in the housing market are now did affect what we see in Wall Street. You know, looking at what happened with Wall Street, you can tie it directly to what was happening in the housing and the mortgage market. That once those cracks started, it reverbed across the American economy. So I'm interested in understanding predatory lending. Where did it occur? Is it clustered? Is it randomly distributed across a city? Is there something place and location specific that made certain residents or certain neighborhoods more susceptible than others? Who is at risk? What are the neighborhood characteristics of the areas where predatory lending is occurring? And I really want to think about how do we model this? And again, I think this is important for really trying still to figure out what happened and where. I think it's an important part as we think about how do we ameliorate the consequences, since it can take not just years but decades for individuals and neighborhoods to rebound. But I also think it's a way to make sure that as we continue to think about consumer protection, think about what the role of home ownership and mortgage lending should be within American society and economy. That until we understand what happened, how can we really make recommendations and evaluate what we have now? And we still don't necessarily understand what was going on. So I apologize. I take you to the east part of the state. Philadelphia is a wonderful city for many reasons. Please humor me. It is one of the largest cities in the nation. Philadelphia is unique that it's long been considered a city of homeowners. It tends to have higher than average homeownership rates. It tends to be considered very affordable when you look at the relationship between the median income and median housing value. It's, in many areas of the city, very accessible and affordable for the average Philadelphian. Another aspect that makes Philadelphia unique is we have a very strong local community development financial institution, the Reinvestment Fund. And in the late 90s and into the 2000s, they were doing some follow-up and program evaluation for affordable housing projects that they had developed. And the goal of these projects, this was a time when homeownership was really viewed as, again, a way to stabilize neighborhoods, help build wealth in individuals. And it was a time we were paying more attention to race and income gaps in homeownership rates. So it was a push to really expand who could become a homeowner, looking at lower and moderate income households. And one of the leading theories is that if we could increase homeownership rates in that population, we would see equity building, we'd see asset accumulation. And these would be benefits not just for the first homeowners we put in, but this would then have benefits for their individuals. When you look at things like, what's the greatest predictor of whether or not you'll be a homeowner? Anyone know? What predicts whether or not someone will be a homeowner? Best predictor.
So, see some of the students will give it a try. Go ahead.
Whether or not your parent is a homeowner is what it comes down to. Children of homeowners tend to have higher educational achievement rates, tend to have higher income rates. There's this very strong link across generations. It's one of the reasons why racial gaps in particularly are concerning, is that when you look at wealth gaps, a lot of that comes back to differences across generations in whether or not there are homeowners, and then looking at the location of where there are homeowners. Because all housing is not equal. Not just the idea that location is important, but fundamentally, the housing value and appreciation rates vary from neighborhood to neighborhood. And when we look at the expansion in homeownership rates post-World War II through the 60s, they were mostly for white Americans in newly constructed developments in the suburbs. And that's when we start to see huge wealth gaps in terms of households. And we start to see both racial as well as economic segregation along those lines. Comes back to home ownership. What the Reinvestment Fund found when they started doing program evaluation was that they had helped to broker these the purchase of affordable housing with below market rate interest rates. They helped to subsidize down payments with the idea that this would be an important part of helping individuals to achieve these benefits of asset accumulation. When they went back to visit, they found out that many of these borrowers had refinanced. They'd refinanced into higher interest loans. In many cases, the principal of those loans had increased, but the individual borrowers did not necessarily see that cash. It wasn't that they were pulling out cash, but fees were being included in these refinanced mortgages that increased the amount of principal owed to the borrowers. And because of the nature of the projects, you know, it was picking apart all those benefits of a below market interest rate, a subsidized down payment. And from an institutional perspective, it caused them to completely change what's going on, how do we do this? Because we put them in the homes, we're helping to finance them. We're expecting that we're now going to be building wealth. We come back and we find out that that's not how it's actually working. We have other actors coming in and disrupting this. So they conducted a random sample of public mortgage data in Philadelphia. Pulled about 2,000 properties across the city. And they then looked at the mortgage history. So they were able to look at outstanding liens on houses, look at things like loan-to-value ratios. Very common with predatory lending, you'll see second and third mortgages that are written at the same time as the first mortgage, to build this large database. At the same time, they conducted interviews with people who were sort of self-identified as victims of predatory lending. They conducted interviews with mortgage brokers, with financial institutions, both in terms of prime and credible borrowers, as well as some of the more questionable lenders, to try and understand what was happening on the ground. And they found that for many of the borrowers, that they had hit hard times and there was a very immediate or emergent need to access the equity in that house. There was a general low level of financial literacy. They also reported active targeting and marketing methods from the financial institutions. So it wasn't just that the borrower was in need of a loan, let me go and take out a loan, but they were receiving phone calls, knocks on the door, mailings, very aggressive tactics. When they interviewed many of the brokers described themselves as really providing a service to individuals and communities, that these borrowers, they needed money. They came to me and I helped them. The reality of that is that brokers don't have a fiduciary relationship to those borrowers. So borrowers believe that they're working with the broker's gonna be paid by me, they work for me, they wanna help me. But really what was happening is that those brokers were one of the cogs in the wheel of predatory and abusive lending practices. That they themselves are able to extract wealth in the form of yield spread premiums, a bonus that the lender gives to the broker for putting people into a mortgage that has a higher interest rate than what they should be considered for. Actually having broker fees where the borrower is paying for that service. And then they helped to include terms that were then beneficial to the lender themselves. Things like prepayment penalties, discouraging people from refinancing and getting out, excessive interest rates. Very often you would have that instead of being a amortized loan and the payment stays the same, you would have that after 2 years there'd be an additional set of payments. After 5 years there would be another one. So the monthly payment could actually be increasing over that time. What I ended up with is about 380 census tracts across the city of Philadelphia, just under 2,000 properties with all of their publicly recorded mortgage data. I included Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data, which right at this time in the early 2000s, starting to be able to identify the differences between subprime and prime, not yet able to identify the true high cost, so ones that have interest rates in excess, like 8%. I treated predatory lending as properties that had mortgages in excess of 110% loan-to-value ratio. Typically speaking, the safest loan is considered to be one that has an 80% loan-to-value ratio or less, meaning that has a traditional 20% down payment. With things like FHA loans and other loans that are meant to encourage homeownership rates in moderate income or in first-time home buyers, you'll start to see 90 to 95% loan-to-value ratios. This is where private mortgage insurance, or PMI, comes in. And that covers the differences between what an 80% principal or 80% loan to value would be versus what's actually there. When you start to get in excess of 100%, what this means is that the amount of the loan far exceeds the value of the property. And when you think about that equation of how we balance risk and how we should be making a decision for whether or not to loan, you know, we want the collateral to cover the risk and the amount. When you hit 110%, that calls into question the idea that the property is adequate collateral. What this means from a predatory lender perspective is that very often they didn't necessarily have to lay out 110%. What they've done is that There's the amount that may have gone to help purchase the home or to refinance. But all that extra is in the form of fees and was an additional way for them to extract. So it's not that they laid out 110% of the value of the property loan. I'm going to give you the extra money. But it's, I'm going to give you this reasonable amount, and then I'm going to charge you all these extra fees, and I'm going to sandwich that into your loan and start charging you interest on it. I mapped where the properties are located and which ones have loan-to-value ratios in excess of 110. Use nearest neighbor hierarchical cluster analysis. It's commonly used in criminal justice. See whether or not properties are clustered, whether or not there's a geographic location-specific component to this. And then I've used discriminant analysis to try and distinguish between the census tracts and neighborhoods that have predatory lending occurring versus areas of the city that seem to be a little bit more protected or safer. This is the citywide sample. If you're not familiar with Philadelphia, we have the airport, we have the river in Fairmont Park. This is the Delaware Riverfront, a lot of industry. That space here is the Northeast Airport. UPS and presidents tend to come out of that airport as opposed to on the south side, where it's the Philadelphia International Airport. For reference, we have University of Pennsylvania, Drexel University, St. Joe's, Temple University, LaSalle. We can leave Chestnut Hill off of that for today. Nearest neighbor hierarchical cluster analysis identifies these clusters. There is, in fact, a geographically specific component to predatory lending. There's a 0.1% chance that these clusters are created by chance. I'm pretty confident in those results. This leads me to say that predatory lending does not randomly occur. That there's something specific about these neighborhoods. There's something specific about the residents in these areas. And this also means to me that if you are located within or close to a cluster, you are more at risk to be victimized than if you're living further away. Again, this idea that place is important, place matters. Looking at the random property sample again. So each one of these dots represents a property that had a loan-to-value ratio that's flagged as predatory lending. The darkest red is either equal to or greater than 110. When you get to the lightest pinks, of which there are many, those are areas where the loan-to-value ratio in those properties was in excess of 140. So keep in mind, most loans are written between 80 to sometimes 95 or 100%. The value of those mortgages to the value of the property is 140%. Because of limitations in the data, it can be hard to figure out why. Is this the result of excess fees? Was this a broker fee? Is this the result of a yield spread premium? While those settlement documents are publicly filed, it's not included in things like the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is now building a database that will have more of this data. They've worked to consolidate forms, so your settlement docs are with your Truth in Lending Act, your TILA docs, that include what the actual APR of interest rates are, and to pull in the good faith estimate, or the GFE, that is supposed to lay out before settlement what costs are going to be so borrowers are aware and know what to take into consideration, but we're not there yet with the data.
Chris, do you want to just say what the value figure for your work came from, the mortgage, the mortgage data that you got, or?
Oh, so the, you mean where did these numbers come from? Oh, so the numbers are,
yeah,
if you total what the amount of the mortgage is and total to what the best estimate of the property value is, Yes.
And how many of your 1,200 transactions are greater than that?
So there's 1,900 properties, and not having my raw data in front of me, I want to say there are at least 100 that are 140. That's my best ballpark for you. It's a sizable number. It's unfortunately not not a true exception. And it happens in different parts of the city, in the city as well. You know, it's not just in one neighborhood, perhaps, that the property estimates are not accurate or not reflecting what's driving the local market. Discriminant analysis reveals that there are significant race and ethnicity differences between the areas experiencing predatory lending and the others. There's differences in income. There's differences in education. They tend to have lower educational levels, lower rates of college graduation, lower rates of high school completion in these neighborhoods. Neighborhood context, that issue of housing age and style tends to be in the areas that have the oldest housing, more likely to be attached, whether it's a twin or a row house, and some of the smaller construction in the city. One of the limitations of the sample, so even though I had 2,000 properties, Philadelphia is a big city. I mentioned I have 380 census tracts. What this translates into is that because of the random sample, tracts have on average between 2 and 5 properties that were sampled out of their tract. So it's a small enough N at the tract level that I don't feel comfortable calculating that as a percent to say 70% of the mortgages in this tract are predatory lending. So I said operationalized it as this is a tract that's either experiencing predatory lending or this is a tract that's not. Again, 2,000, it's a big sample, but it's also a big city. So having to break that in, one of the unfortunate limitations. And you know, we can look at there are ones where, actually, let me go back to the random sample, excuse me. There's, especially up here in West Philly, where a lot of them that were being pulled were identified as predatory lending. I don't necessarily expect that every loan in that neighborhood or that tract is a predatory loan. I don't think that that fairly, trying to treat it as a percent of what happens at the tract level is the appropriate way to consider. Another source of data I've used to try and model and understand what's happened with predatory lending is the National Mortgage Data Repository. This was a coordinated effort in 2009 by the National Consumer Law Center, where they'd been having an increase in clients coming into their partner organizations, where it was individuals who were likely victims of predatory lending. They were looking for legal advice. Either they were in foreclosure, trying to avoid foreclosure. In many ways, this was a relatively self-selected group. These were community organizations working with individuals in neighborhoods that were having difficulty. So another limitation is it's not necessarily a full representation of all mortgages that were being lent. But it's extremely unique in many of these cases, individuals came in with all of their lending documents. So it provides an opportunity to really drill down on individual cases of predatory lending and look at things like their good faith estimate, the Truth in Lending Act documentation. There are HUD-1 and HUD-1A settlement forms. HUD-1 is what was used before October 2015 when the CFPB changed the new form that I was telling you about that includes the Truth in Lending Act, the Good Faith, and the settlement form. This is what was used beforehand. A HUD-1A is when there's not a seller, so this is what would be used for like a refinance because it's a different type of transaction. The actual loan note documents were also included. One of my students once made this for me, and I want to share it with you. So the person sitting at the desk says, gee, I'd like to have a loan, but I haven't saved any money for a down payment, and I don't think I can afford the monthly payments. Can you help me? And the person at the desk says, sure, since the value of your house will always go up, we don't even need down payments anymore. And you know, very crudely stick figure drawing, this kind of summarizes what the mindset was in the 2000s, is the idea that writing mortgages are a safe and effective way for institutions and for things like brokers to help make money, that they're safe. Homeownership is wonderful. People love being homeowners. They always pay their mortgage. And in case they don't, houses go up in value over time. And I hope we now know that those are very faulty assumptions. Any changes in someone's economic situation, a change in employment, unemployment, affects their ability to pay their mortgage. Sometimes people will buy a house and assume a mortgage with the hopes that in 5 years I'll have a promotion, and if it's an adjustable rate mortgage and the loan becomes more expensive, I'll be able to cover it because I'll have had a promotion, I'll have had an increase. One of the things that made the 2007 recession extremely difficult is that we saw economic decline and rises in unemployment. It was right at that time period where many of these loans were changing over, and people were no longer able to kind of maintain that expectation that their income would either remain the same over time or would be increasing, which led to more defaults, unfortunately. I like to pay special attention to brokers. And as I mentioned, brokers don't have a fiduciary relationship. Many people seek out a broker. They're not experienced. People typically buy less than 4 homes in a lifetime. It's not an everyday occurrence for an individual. These documents are legal documents. Most of us don't have a legal background. We're not lawyers. So it's viewed that brokers are a way to help shepherd us through the process. Brokers are typically paid either the borrower pays a broker fee, then get a yield spread premium. That would be, again, the lender, the institution, compensating the broker because they, in effect, put the borrower in a loan with a higher interest rate than what they could have qualified for. So they get paid on the difference between what they would have qualified for versus what was the interest rate that the broker put them in. And I like to pay attention to the loan terms and differences in the loan terms between loans that were brokered and unbrokered. I view it that brokers lie right in the middle between lenders and borrowers, and they help to control that flow of information. They are able to take advantage of a borrower's lack of financial literacy or understanding of what type of individual credit risk they represent, which can lead to higher loan terms. On the other side, they can also misrepresent the borrower to the lending institution. They can overstate either through how they document or failure to document other expenses and income that may hide the inherent risk of the borrower to the lender. That if the lender fully understood what the represented risk was, they might not agree to it. And so the broker right there really represents where you can see significant information asymmetry emerge. They are not regulated. There's not a lot of requirements typically for what it takes to be a mortgage broker. Often you can just take a test. There's not necessarily an expectation for a number of credits or licensing the way like a certified public accountant would be. It's not being a lawyer. You don't have 3 years of law school and you have to pass the bar. It's not being a planner where you need to work. Then you can take your certification exam and then you do your continuing maintenance. There's lots of differences too between state levels, and you can have brokers operating across state lines. So it becomes blurry too in terms of what one state might require versus what's required where the broker is. In the National Mortgage Data Repository data, I distinguish between loans with fixed interest rates versus adjustable rate mortgages. So where the mortgage is initiated with one interest rate and the expectation is that it will change over time. Of fixed loans, about 15% only had a broker fee. Almost 6% included a yield spread premium, and almost 7% included both, meaning the broker is being compensated by the borrower as well as from the lender directly. They're basically double dipping. For adjustable rate mortgages, kind of comparable levels in terms of a broker fee only, yield spread premium only, but an even higher rate of where brokers are double dipping and getting compensated by both the borrower as well as the institution. Comes down to, I'm paying for a service, and as a borrower, they're going to help me. They're going to work for me.
from an institution, from a lender perspective, thanks for helping me write a great mortgage where I'm going to make more money. I appreciate it. Let me be compensated by both. For loan values, see a difference, and this is one of the signals that a loan might be predatory, when there's differences between what the initial application amount was and then what was actually written. Victims of predatory lending report that they're pressured into having mortgages that are a higher amount than they wanted. Looking at their loan documents, they tend to, again, be building in fees and things that are charged at the point of closing that then just get added on to the principal. There's some small fluctuation between all brokered loans for fixed interest, again, with what the initial value was when the application was made versus what the actual loan amount was. Pretty comparable, same thing unbrokered. But when you look at adjustable rate mortgages that are brokered, the initial application value averaged $212,000. The average loan value is $320,000. Mm-hmm. By comparison, unbrokered adjustable rate mortgages had that same small fluctuation that we saw across all types of fixed interest. So it's a sign that with the adjustable rate mortgages, that there's an awful lot of leveraging, possibly influencing, perhaps bullying tactics going on here that are leading borrowers into higher loans. This could be that they're getting a lower initial rate with the exchange being that they're paying points or a percentage of the loan amount that gets paid at the start of the loan as opposed to an interest rate you will pay over time. This could be in the form of broker fees that they get added on. But I find that alarming, that increase. For settlement fees, for fixed interest loans, whether it was a brokered loan or an unbrokered loan, about $13,000 is what those settlement fees are. Small difference between 16 and 18% of the total loan value. Coming over to adjustable rate mortgages, not that difference in settlement fees between here. And for the brokered loans, it represents a much smaller portion of the total loan amount. And to me, I think that this is how, with how those loan documents are being drawn up and what's being classified as a settlement fee and what's not being cost, I think it's an area of misrepresentation, perhaps malfeasance. And I think that this is deceptive because if we go back, remember, these are the loans where they end up about 50% higher than what the applicant initially applied for. So it's a much greater inflated final loan amount. As I mentioned, there's limitations. And this really also is why I've been committed to trying to piece out and understand predatory lending over time, is assuming there are not major changes made at the federal government level, and assuming that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is not picked apart and their programs are eliminated. In several years, we should have better data. We have better disclosures that are being done at the time mortgages are written. And then because we're collecting data that will be publicly available, we'll be able to revisit. And I hope that it will have the similar type of impact that the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data had on lending in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. That we can use it to understand which areas have mortgage capital flowing in. Are financial institutions meeting the needs of the residents in which they have local offices and branches? It'll help us to understand the costs of these loans. Understand, are there differences along race and economic characteristics in terms of the type of loan that's being made, what the costs of those loans are? But we're not there yet. We saw improvements with Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data in the late 2000s. But there's still a long way to go in terms of how do we standardize what fees are charged when and how they're categorized
and then how that's disclosed. That things like broker fees are not included as part of the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data. That was data that was mandated because there were geographic disparities and racial disparities in mortgage application rates, approval and denial rates, and then the actual writing of loans. That was before we had predatory lending, so it's not able to give us that level of data to really understand its pervasiveness and to try and understand why is it happening and how, you know, unless we understand how and why it's happening, how can we design and implement policy effectively to prevent it? You know, it's kind of trying to get a handle on an amorphous amoeba. I feel absolutely confident that there's a spatial aspect to predatory abusive lending practices. I think that there are neighborhood-specific variables that impact. When you have an organization that is committed to promoting financial literacy, that's an advantageous institution. You'll have individual borrowers who will be more knowledgeable, be more experienced, be more confident, and have those social capital connections that when it comes time to sit down at the table for settlement, that if something doesn't look right, they have the knowledge either to see it for what it is, or they have the support to raise attention and look for support elsewhere. I think that with this spatial component to it, that what this also means is as we look to build financial literacy, as we look to improve more equal and more appropriate access to credit, that we should be targeting. We should be looking at the areas that are most devoid, that have been most challenged in accessing credit fairly, and concentrate our efforts there, that those are the ones most at risk and will suffer the worst consequences and the longest lasting damage. So I think there's a strong incentive that we should be looking to concentrate and identify neighborhoods, whether it's for a pilot program or as we look then to implement across on a city level. That should be our starting point. For predatory lending, very often it's described as porn. I'll know it when I see it. There are so many different forms that predatory lending can take that it's hard to have one explicit, discrete decision other than in its abusive lending practice. It can be fees, it can be interest rate, it can be amortization, it can be forcing a borrower into a loan that is greater in amount than they want to. There's so many different forms. So in many ways, how we define predatory lending is tied to how we can understand predatory lending, how we can examine it, which is really tied, again, to this idea of data and a need to have a quantitative foundation. As I mentioned, that predatory lending, the more time I spend with it, it's, to me, very heart-wrenching to think that it comes from having dual and exclusive mortgage markets where people and neighborhoods were excluded, and this social justice and economic justice push to open up credit, that we've now created a new form of mortgage discrimination. And instead of it being binary, yes or no, do I have a mortgage? It comes down to what is the cost of that mortgage? And they come with different consequences. The mortgage is being written at a higher cost and a greater risk to borrowers. And one of the goals of opening up credit was not just it's fair and everyone should be equal, but it was also this goal to really be able to increase the number and the diversity of individuals who are able to reap those benefits of homeownership. And instead, this is undermining and taking some of the individuals who would most benefit from asset accumulation and the economic and social benefits of homeownership and pulling the rug out from underneath them. One of my favorite quotes comes from Dan Immergluck's book, Foreclosed. No skin in the game leads to finding the greater fool. You know, when you think about the role of individuals such as brokers, whether a loan performs or not, whether a borrower defaults or not, doesn't affect a broker. None of their compensation is tied to the performance of mortgages. They get compensated at the onset. They have no skin in the game. The more loans that they can write, the more they get paid. There's no fiduciary relationship. There's little incentive for them to be writing and helping to broker loans that are appropriate and fair for both borrowers as well as for lenders. And a great Woody Guthrie quote I want to leave you with. Yes, as through this world I've wandered, I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. I hope you've enjoyed my presentation. Can I take any questions?
Thanks, Kristen. Let's open it up for questions.
Rhiannon Gallo with Mellon and Monterey Associates. We do a lot of geographic analysis of mortgage denial using similar data. Have you looked at the relationship between clustering of predatory lending and clustering of mortgage denial? And if so, do you find that there's a relationship between the two?
I haven't yet. I have a long wish list. And that is on my wish list. One of the issues I run into with the mortgage denial is how HMDA rate, how HMDA data classify something as a denial or not. They have all the reasons for why an application is pulled. And so I haven't been able to parse out the data to where I feel confident was an application made in good faith and denied that I can sort of compare with this. It's one of the issues I have with race in the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data as well. I've seen evidence that, especially for a lot of the out-of-state and the rise of kind of internet and phone brokers, is everything gets classified as race unknown. And so it really calls into question, what are the divides you're seeing between black and white when the data is not being consistently applied? I would love to hear more how your experience is with denial rates, because that's something I have a huge question of. And I wonder times too, because you have the initial application is made, and then why it's pulled or whether it's not completed. And I wonder sometimes if things are being categorized as being pulled or incomplete because it prevents the institution from having to report it as a denial.
Well, we usually find that when we pull out all those variables, there's still, and even if, when you pull income study, there's still a lot of variance between different races. So, and there's still a lot of, the geographical clustering varies depending on the location.
A lot.
Do you have any additional?
That's very reassuring and very unsettling to hear. I'm happy to hear that the data is parsing out and it's unsettling to hear the results that you're finding.
I didn't mean to cut you off, I'm sorry, yes?
No, even if you throw out all the stuff you just said that you don't know about, there's still data that shows that denial rates are not, are disparate.
Sort of on the wish list of there's so many, I try to start and go. Michael, did you
have? Yeah, thanks for a great talk. I guess one of the obvious policy recommendations, has come from this would be greater regulation in the brokerage industry, right, just to try and get some skin in the game. But beyond that, do you find it somewhat problematic that greater mortgage literacy it's just going to be bringing more potentially vulnerable people into a system that tends to be rigged against them? And then maybe it's a broader question about the rhetoric of promotion that needs to be addressed.
I would argue that those are two separate concerns. I have concerns about homeownership being the default and the preferred housing policy. It often comes at the result of housing assistance in terms of rental assistance. Homeownership is not for everyone. There can be a variety of reasons. I often view it as a form of welfare for the middle class, that when you look at the foregone revenue because of the deduction of mortgage interest, it's a massive amount of foregone revenue. So I have concerns about, in general, people being pushed in. I have concerns about low and moderate income buyers being pushed, or potential borrowers being pushed in, that where their incomes are, it's not an area that's well served in terms of the diversity and the value of housing. It tends to be a very small portion. So I often question whether or not it's truly considered affordable, and I consider that population to be exceptionally susceptible to any changes in income or employment status. We think about homeownership and it being a multi-year commitment. about the mortgage literacy, I would like to be an optimist. And I would like to suggest that starting to build improved financial literacy at a middle and junior high school and through high school has benefits beyond just sitting down at the mortgage. And I would hope that even if people are more confident and savvy, that won't prevent to an, that won't lead to an overconfidence where, you know, I don't want it to be like the self-defense class, you know, you take a self-defense class and now suddenly you feel like you can protect yourself in any situation. I'd like to think that building financial literacy will give you the tools in order to understand whether or not you have a handle on things seem appropriate versus I need to seek outside assistance. But it is a concern that too much confidence and too much information might have.
The other question I guess I would take about is, were you surprised? Were you anticipating the recurrence of a spatial aspect to these lending practices? Because it seems like capital has gotten better at targeting potential consumers with a lot better accuracy than maybe back in the 1930s,
mm-hmm.
Given the prevalence of data. So were you anticipating those effects?
I was relieved to find those effects because I was so confident that they were there. I thought they were there because I expected it to, that, you know, the access to mortgages and homeownership that we saw in the 30s and 40s to what we saw in the 60s and 70s, I expected that to be compounding and leading to big differences. When I read the interview transcriptions that the Reinvestment Fund had done of individual borrowers, they report mass mailings. When they interviewed some of these marketing firms, it sounds like they were using census data to target areas that had a higher level of population, 65 and over, high rates of home ownership, and low rates of mortgages. And the census collects the data, or collects information based on, is there a mortgage on that property? So the qualitative data suggested that the marketing was absolutely having this spatial component based on, you know, people who didn't have a loan or perhaps were going to be less financial savvy. Looking at traditional patterns and then looking at the other literature in terms of who was most marginalized, most at risk, most underserved, I thought that those three factors were going to have this clustering effect.
From the, I guess from the qualitative data or from either part, do you have a sense of the demographic composition of the 100 or so that were in the cluster groups? I'll say what we did some work here, and it was with some people that were already in foreclosure, but there was very much, we didn't confirm, but evidence of steering, but particularly for African-American single mothers and clusters in the eastern suburbs of places that previously, 30 years ago or even 20 years ago, wouldn't have been places where that population would be buying houses if they were buying houses, but very much evidenced by the industry of steering them into various neighborhoods. And in these cases, they were places where home values had declined somewhat. Largely working class neighborhoods with somewhat declining home, not some of the further neighborhoods where they went through the floor, but somewhat so that there was evidence very much so when you mapped out where the foreclosures were of steering in a particular demographic groups.
Elvin Wiley, his take on the National Mortgage Data Repository was to look at gender, age, and race of those files that had been assembled. So again, it's not a random sample, they're all troubled loans, but far and wide, his analysis confirms it was almost always African American or black, single women, and it was kind of a mix between with children or over the age of 65. But far and wide, that's what part of the demographic was. I missed part of the question, I think. What was the...
In the neighborhoods where they were steered into certain neighborhoods, mm-hmm. And in Philadelphia, I was trying to figure out where some of them were. I could guess a couple of them.
Well, you know, the other part that's on my wish list, kind of like the denial rates, is thinking about social networks and thinking about institutions, where some of these brokers reported that they were able to have relationships with pastors and community organizations, and they would set up the grass after service on Sundays. And the way that they had represented themselves to pastors was that I'm providing a service to your population. I'm helping to bring capital in here. And the reality of it was is that in many cases, these were people who weren't looking for loans, or these were not necessarily the most affordable, least costly loans that they would have qualified for. But because they kind of came with the implied support of the local entity, people were more likely to write those loans. I've seen stories of, well, my neighbor got a loan and they were able to use the money for X, Y, and Z, so I got the number of their guy. That it seems that very often word of mouth and kind of those local relationships increases the likelihood of whether or not someone would sit down to talk with a broker or lender and then whether or not they would go through. Yes?
Could we look at that question again?
Yes! This one?
Yes.
Okay. So this is Strawberry Mansion. This is getting close to kind of Kensington and almost Frankfurt. The many different neighborhoods of South Philadelphia. And then this little sliver is around kind of Mantua, not far from Drexel in West Philadelphia. Yes, Devin.
Like the Community Reinvestment Act, for instance, covers some types of lenders, but not others.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any sense of who were some of the types of lenders that were driving some of this behavior, and also what their other sort of responsibilities were?
Mm-hmm. So it often, again, coming back down to kind of that those data limitations, because everyone's not required to report through HUBMed anyway. My research and research of others suggests that independent mortgage companies, they do report through HMDA, but are different than some of the more traditional finance institutions, that they are more likely to write high-cost loans than others. There are many out-of-state banks that were writing these predatory loans. And this is where, again, to me, that question of brokers comes into play. For the random sample across Philadelphia, I didn't have access to whether or not those were brokered loans or not. In many cases, couldn't get the full settlement forms. But kind of triangulating that with the results out of the National Mortgage Data Repository, I would suspect that the large number of out-of-state non-local lenders was the result of brokers working on those loans, as opposed to the direct marketing and lending activities of them. One of the mortgage brokers, he would describe, you know, he really believed he was doing a service to the community, a service to individuals. And he would describe how he would orient the picture that he would include in the settlement documents to the out-of-state lenders, that he could take the picture so you wouldn't know that it was actually an end-of-row house or a twin, and it would look like it was a single-family detached house. Or, you know, you might change the address so you're not necessarily correctly representing what section of the city it's in or what neighborhood. But there are sort of these areas where the information was not always appropriately and perhaps ethically communicated as a way to kind of increase the likelihood that those loans would be written.
Chris, has anyone done kind of the kind of recap on how many brokers in various places got convicted?
I don't think so. There's a, you know, the more I write, I feel it's almost like the, you know, Aquilov's work, the idea that it's a criminogenic market, that the way subprime lending and the way predatory lending, there are so many opportunities, and the more that you kind of misrepresent what the product is, the more opportunity there is for profit.
Yeah, because, I mean, one thing was, you know, with all the things in the aftermath was the lack of any kind of conviction of the financial institutions who, at the end of the day, are the driving force of broker, you know, of the, whatever those small baskets of the pony, baloney,
mortgage baskets.
Yeah. But in the brokerage world, there are brokers that did, you know, I wonder if some places where, I know we know a lot in about Cleveland from our friends there, so we've got some idea, but I wonder if anybody done anything internationally.
It's tough for brokers because unless you can actually prove the misrepresentation, so they even very often have very slim ethical codes. So you're like, we can say it's an ethical violation, but you know they don't have the same guiding principles that a CPA that a lawyer has.
Yeah.
You know, that to me the missing part is that fiduciary relationship that they're legally obligated to represent. You know, they're just kind of like a middleman. They're just kind of greasing the wheels. Then there's been some, I know, discussion of prosecuting the raiders of the mortgage-backed securities, the rating agencies. But then that ends up being an issue of whether or not they were intentionally misrepresenting what the risk was of that bundle, or if the issue was that the loan documentation and settlement documents themselves did not represent what the risk was. And you know, you're supposed to create bundles where they're similar loans, they represent similar risks, but at times they'd be pulling in higher risk loans and kind of sneaking them into the bundles to pass them through. Shenanigans. Yes?
I have some questions about how many data set you used. Was that just 1 year's worth of?
So I didn't present all of it today, but I used several years, because you know, with the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act data, it's only going to give you originations within that one calendar year. So as part of the larger project, I tried to look at what percentage of loans were subprime, what some of the differences in the loan values were, and then looking at trajectories and change. So were these areas that subprime lending had kind of been constant, increased, or decreased? And it was more of a neighborhood contextual variable as I was trying to understand what was happening with the random sample of properties.
Well, I'm just also curious why you used a random sample of properties and not just the whole data set.
Because it's basically not accessible. You have to pay to get those properties, and then the amount of time it takes, because the way it comes out is you sort of like, you have to look at each individual property. When you look at Philadelphia, we're talking about probably between 400 and 600,000 properties. There's no digital database. It was sort of extracted on a sort of paper basis and then digitized. If you have years and money, I'd be happy to work on a full sample, but until the city of Philadelphia makes the data available, it's just not.
I thought you could get it at the census tract level for all.
For the number of, because the random sample was, so for an individual property, what was that property value, and then what were the outstanding liens on it? So if you took it up to the census tract, you'd lose that grain of understanding. But no one, unfortunately, no one collects what are the loan to value ratios. So there's no way of knowing there are 3,000 properties in this census tract, and 1,000 of them have loan to value ratios below 80, you know, 50.
So you were comparing the, this is probably boring for everyone else.
I usually think this is boring for everyone else, so I'm excited to be in the room. I feel like I'm with my people. Thank you.
Well, Kristen, I want to thank you again.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.